Or a massive mural of sea glass arranged into a spiraling pattern of paths.
It's a labyrinth.
I look up toward the voice, shielding my eyes against the reflecting light to find Margaret in the back of the workshop. She's wearing a lilac boiler suit with its sleeves rolled up, and her silver hair is knotted into a pom-pom atop her head. She pulls a pair of protective goggles from her eyes up onto her forehead as I step inside.
Like a maze? I ask, glancing around the room.
A series of long, scarred tables have been arranged around the outside edge of the workshop, their tops covered in tools and wire, glass and shells and driftwood. Over each of the windows, an elaborate wind chime hangs, slowly twirling, waiting for a true breeze to make them dance.
Not quite, she says. It's unicursal. There's only one path in and out. It's not quite the game of a maze. You can't get lost. You just walk the path, and it won't be the shortest way to get where you're going, but you'll wind up in the center eventually. As you walk, you're supposed to meditate.
On? I ask.
Whatever you want, she says.
What do you meditate on? I ask.
Usually what I want for lunch.
Even the sparkle in her eye can't distract from the obvious dodge. Margaret Ives has an answer locked and loaded to that question, and I'm not getting it. Not yet. I wander around the workshop, studying the things she's made and the things she's working on at the tables. It's cooler here, thanks to the shade of the roof and the ceiling fans, but not by much. The humidity holds the summer in the workshop's walls, and the open windows bring in nothing but brackishness. I gently run my fingers through one of her wind chimes, listening to the soft clatter and tinkle. There are more mosaics on the walls, like the one on the floor, though smaller, and trapped in both resin and driftwood frames. Most are abstract or arranged in geometric patterns, like someone took a Hilma off Klimt painting, shattered it, and put the pieces back together with their rough, jagged edges.
Those don't do so hot with the tourists, Margaret says, coming to stand at my shoulder. They mostly want turtles and palm trees.
They're also a great tool for helping desperate journalists track you down, I remind her. She chuckles, turning back to her tool-strewn tables.
You mind if I work while we talk?
Sure. Are we recording today? I traipse after her, dropping my bag on the far end of the surface and sinking onto the schoolhouse-style stool there, feeling like I'm back in art class freshman year. She makes a gesture like, be my guest, then pulls her goggles back into place. I notice then that it's not just tiny, smooth pieces of sea glass arranged in front of her, but also full bottles, aluminum cans, and down on the floor, buckets of sand and grime-coated trash, things she must have found on the beach or maybe floating in the marsh. There's a sink in the rear corner of the space, and on the countertop next to it, more bottles and cans are arranged on a drying rack as though freshly rinsed.
Here.
Margaret holds a pair of goggles out to me, and I put them on, then set up my phone and recorder between us. She pulls on some purple work gloves, drapes a towel over a green beer bottle, and cracks a hammer down against it. I try not to jump at the sound, but even muffled by the terry cloth, it's harsh.
So, where did we leave off? Margaret asks.
Well, I flip through my notes. Another harsh crash as the hammer comes down again. I've conducted full interviews while an interviewee was pounding away at a Peloton stationary bike class. I should be able to drown out the sounds of Margaret's work and focus. She opens the towel to rearrange the pieces, then flops it back into place and keeps breaking them down. I debate bringing up the Ebner Hotel of it all right then. But if there is something worth poking around there, I don't want her to close off before we can get to it. This month is about building trust. Lawrence had just bought his first newspaper. He'd gotten settled in San Francisco and sent for his sister, but she wouldn't come.
Right, right, she says.
But we don't have to pick up there, I say. I'm excited to hear more about you whenever you're ready.
This is about me, Alice, she says pointedly. I told you that.
All right, then. I gesture for her to go on. Three more taps of the hammer first. Clink, clink, clink.
Lawrence's sister begged him to come home and make amends, to stop his quest for more. Instead, he decided it was time to start a new family, one of his own. He was around 40 when he met Amelia Lowe, of the San Francisco Lowes. As she says this, she does a little eye roll, like she knows it's pretentious to describe someone this way, but it simply can't be helped. I suppress a laugh. A railroad family, she explains, aka rich. Anyway, Amelia's father hated Lawrence, hated. She notices my expression. You're surprised. A bit, I admit. Everything I read suggested it was a kind of, not an arranged marriage, but, you know, a business decision, like things used to be back then. She lifts her eyes to mine, a smirk lurking on her lips. That's by design. See, Lawrence wanted to marry Amelia, and Amelia wanted out from under her domineering father. She saw an opportunity with Lawrence, but her father forbade them from seeing each other. So they eloped.
Margaret punctuates the word with a hearty whack of her hammer.
Mr. Lowe was furious, of course, but by then Lawrence had acquired four more papers. And wouldn't you know it, in the days following their elopement, each of his five papers ran its own story about the union of these two powerful families. It was sheer flattery, praising the Lowes, spreading gossip about business that hadn't happened yet. It forced Lowe's hand.
She opens the towel, arranges the glass, replaces the towel, swings the hammer.
Amelia was welcomed right back into the fold, and what's more, Mr. Lowe and Lawrence went into business together. Everyone got what they wanted out of it.
And then your grandfather Gerald was born, right? I say. A few years after Amelia and Lawrence got married?
That's right.
She covers the glass with the towel again, hits it with the hammer.
In 1875, Gerald Rupert Ives came screaming into the world.
She flicks a glance my way.
He was the one who built the House of Ives as the world knows it. But I've always thought of him as the beginning of the end, the stepping stone that decided the entire path, the first domino that tipped, the one who, for better or worse, set every moment of my life into motion.
The story. Their version. Gerald Ives created modern journalism. He was also a failed politician, a lavish partier, and a womanizer who abandoned his family without batting an eye. Her version. Gerald Ives never spoke an ill word of his father, but he never once heard his father say a kind word about him. Gerald was raised to be a businessman and was hardly 8 years old when he first realized he'd been born in the red, in debt, at a loss. He came out with his father's face and an expectation he could never live up to, no matter how many tutors his parents locked him in a room with. He was supposed to do great things. That was the contract Lawrence thought he'd entered into with the universe, and thus every second Gerald didn't, he was failing. He was disappointing. He was falling short. Things were different for his younger sister. 8 years after Gerald was born, Georgiana Gigi Ives arrived, firmly in the black. Beautiful like her mother, quiet like her father, quick-witted like both of them. And she was naturally content, which only earned her more adoration. Gigi went where she pleased. She did as she wished. She studied painting and dance and piano and played out in the grass with the nanny on sunny days. And Gerald watched through the window, his tutor barking at him again, again, until every math problem was solved, every Italian verb correctly conjugated, every important mining-related fact memorized and recited back. Their house in San Francisco was large and opulent, but to him it felt like a cage he paced, searching for weak points. He tried, at so many points in his life, he tried to codify what it was that made his father detest him, or what exactly about Gigi and his mother drew out that small, soft smile on his father's lips. Yvay could drift light as sunbeams across the house, and he would watch them go more than approvingly, when only Gerald's rage could ever turn his father's eye. Once, after they'd fought, Gerald had gone into an outbuilding on their property and punched a hole clean through the wall. His mother had found him there, still shaking with unspent energy, even as blood dripped down the back of his hand to the cold dirt floor. Gently, she'd touched his shoulders.
"He's afraid, you know," she told him. "That's why he's so hard on you."
Gerald had nodded, and later wished he hadn't. He didn't know. He'd never seen any evidence at all that Lawrence Ives was afraid of anything, and even on his deathbed, Gerald would wonder what his mother had meant that day. But instead of asking, he'd tucked away his anger, tamped it down, it did no good anyway, and did only and exactly what his father asked, until he was 25, and finally, Lawrence deemed him responsible enough to join the family business. Sort of. He gave him a newspaper. One. "A trial," Lawrence had said, without even meeting his son's eyes, simply scribbling his signature to make the change official. "Look at me," Gerald remembered thinking. "Just look at me, for once." He didn't. 1 week after Gerald took charge of the San Francisco Daily Dispatch, he changed the motto to "Where Truth is King." 1 week after that, he cleaned house. He and his father didn't fight about it. They didn't talk about it. But for the first time, Gerald knew Lawrence was watching him. Gerald didn't understand mining. He had no natural talent for prospecting. He'd never feel the silver calling out to him from deep within the earth. But he had something his father didn't, a fearlessness. If everything fell apart, Gerald thought, who cared? This was his chance, and he'd never get another one. He had to keep his father's eye on him, and that meant taking big swings. He bet everything he had on talent. He poached the best writers, the best cartoonists, the best editors from the Pulitzer family's papers, and the Hearst's presses, too. He nearly doubled his new staff's pay, and with the money he had left, he bought the newest and best equipment. Gerald Ives never spoke ill of his father, but he ran his newspaper with a vengeance. Lawrence had raised him to be a businessman, but his mother had raised him to be a populist, and he took all of her ideals and fed them back to the people for a price. He attacked corruption. He pointed out hypocrisy. "The truth is king," he told his staff again and again, and his readers, too, who began to have the sense that maybe all the other newspapers of record weren't quite telling the truth. Some of his competitors folded. Others he acquired. He ran two of his father's papers into the ground, then bought them out from under him, and still the two men sat across the dinner table from each other in silence, Lawrence's eyes discreetly lifting off his soup to take inventory of his only son. For the first time in Gerald's life, he was in control. He decided when and how and by whom he would be seen. What was more, he shaped the world around his readers, told them whom to rage against, what to fear. His writers could come in late, come in drunk, not come in at all, so long as they performed their duties to his liking. Which meant even those he hadn't poached in his first wave of domination came running soon enough. Talent was his silver. It called out to him, and he needed to possess it. One of his writers, in particular, had a knack for penning headlines. His articles were shit, but it didn't matter, and Gerald saw that. The headline was enough. The headline told the story, and then a person's eyes simply glazed over as they wandered down the ink-ridden page. Who are you angry with? What do you fear? What do you love most in the world, and how could it be taken from you? These were the things he drilled into his staff. The truth was king, but emotion was the truth's most valuable advisor. Soon, San Francisco wasn't enough. Then, not even California. The true seat of power, he understood, was in New York. Only once he had both states, both cities, unified in the press, could he rest. At the turn of the 20th century, he crossed the country and began his second wave of domination. The first paper he bought in New York City was a bust. The second one folded too. People on the East Coast regarded him with distrust. But once again, his nose for talent did him right when he met Rosalind Goodlett. She was plain-faced and petite, almost childlike in appearance, and mostly concerned herself with charity for the poor and sick. She was also the daughter of a senator. Yes, Gerald had fashioned himself as the purveyor of truth, but somehow that hadn't added up to personal trust in him. After all, his own newspapers spent the bulk of their time and space calling to the public's attention the many moral failings of the wealthiest and most powerful, and at a certain point, there was no avoiding the fact that Gerald himself had entered this stratum. People trusted Rosalind, perhaps because she wasn't beautiful, or because of the innocence in her eyes, or maybe it was a game whose rules she'd figured out, but in any case, Gerald watched her and he knew. She had a rare talent. The way Gerald saw it, though, her father was a man who'd merely gotten lucky and tripped into a position of authority, which made him corruptible. Gerald didn't ask Rosalind to marry him. He showered Senator Goodlett with gifts, then suggested an alliance. When the senator arranged Gerald's marriage to Rosalind, he more or less passed Gerald Ives the key to New York. Within 3 months of their wedding, he'd purchased two powerful papers in the city, filled them with his people, covered them with his fingerprints. Then he took his young wife and went back to California. He wasn't a cruel man. He didn't take her money as his own. She gave him what he most dearly wanted. Why shouldn't he let her have her own wish? All she really wanted, like him, was to do her work. And yes, her work consisted primarily of spending money, but every penny she spent on her philanthropy came back to him in the form of goodwill, another kind of investment, though not one his father understood or approved of. Not yet, anyway. Rosalind did not love Gerald, he knew that, but she respected him, and he respected her, too, more than he could have guessed at the beginning. They became something more than husband and wife. They were partners. He did not bed his wife for the first 3 years of their marriage. He waited for her to come to him. Afterward, they lay in bed and talked for hours, dreamed of everything they might someday have. He ran one hand over her mousy blonde hair, and he looked at her closely for the first time and saw that she could be beautiful, that all it took was looking long enough, close enough, and he was ashamed that he hadn't. In 1904, they produced a son, Frederick Ives, followed by a daughter, Francine, and he was determined to be good to them, both of them. It was like his marriage, like poaching Pulitzer's people, like buying the newest printing press, like Rosalind's philanthropy, an investment. Twice a week, Gerald took his wife and children to dine with his parents in their tasteful Victorian manse. Gigi had married an Englishman and moved to Europe, but even in his sister's absence, Gerald received no more of their father's attention. That all went to Freddie. Little Freddie, whom Gerald had let run wild, who flailed in his studies, who had plenty of his warm, good-hearted mother in him, and very little Ives, except his looks. Gerald didn't understand it. How both of his parents were all too happy to dote on his own silly, playful, unambitious son, while Gerald himself still hadn't managed to glean an ounce of his father's approval. Maybe that was why he pursued the California State Senate. If the money and business acumen weren't enough to put him in the black, then perhaps political power might. Back then, senators were elected by state legislatures rather than popular votes, and with all the connections he'd accumulated, Gerald more or less walked into the position. In 1909, he was sworn in, and he and Rosalind began planning for an eventual ascent to the White House. Even with the full force of the press behind them, though, when the presidential election came around, the caucus chose someone else. 4 years later, he tried again. Again, they chose someone else. And while Gerald was still smarting from the failure, Lawrence abruptly fell ill. Gerald rushed to be at his father's side, but even on his deathbed, Lawrence had nothing to say to his son. Instead, for several days, he raged and wept and apologized to people who weren't there. He begged a faceless specter to come home, and then finally seemed to get the answer he wanted. In 1919, at 89 years old, Lawrence found his first shred of peace. Then he closed his eyes, smiled softly, and took his last breath. It was as if all the hunger that had lived trapped inside his body slipped out on that last exhale, then snaked its way into Gerald's lungs, where it writhed and snapped like a viper. To Gerald, that bottomless pit of a nameless want felt less like hunger and more like rage, an anger so violent he thought it might, would, destroy anything it touched. For the first time since his teenage years, he stormed into his childhood bedroom and punched the wall. Then he punched it again and again until the blood from his knuckles was smeared across the wallpaper. When Rosalind came to him, he shoved his wife from the room and locked the door, letting the rage consume him. He destroyed his cherrywood dresser. He ripped the drapes from the window. He battered the bedpost until he was too tired to fight anymore, to think anymore, and that was a relief. He left San Francisco a week after that. He couldn't stand to be there any longer, couldn't stand to be seen by his wife or his children, or to watch his mother mourn the father who'd never loved him. He left them, all of them, and went somewhere new, unfamiliar and without ghosts. He was convinced that in Hollywood, he could sweat his fury out like a fever. But that wasn't what happened. His first night in town, at 44 years old, Gerald Ives fell in love. He sat in a lounge sipping a martini and he looked up at the stage and saw her, lit up like an angel. Untamable red-gold hair, strange green eyes, a voice like a flame singeing paper. She was no more beautiful than Rosalind, but she was striking. Her presence not only invited but demanded attention, and it was such a relief to give it, to feel that instead of a bottomless pit of rage. His want was an ocean he could drown in, not a lack of something but an excess of it. When she finished her performance, she walked straight off the stage to his table and introduced herself. Nina Gill had been trying to break into film with about as much luck as Gerald with national politics. Films were still silent then, and half of Nina's power was in the sound of her voice. Unlike Gerald, or even Gerald's wife, Nina didn't hunger for wealth, power, or change. It wasn't stardom she was after. She wanted only beauty and pleasure. And lucky for Gerald, he was an undeniably beautiful man, more so in middle age than he had been in his youth. As for the pleasure piece of things, he lost himself in his pursuit of it with her. Drinking, dancing, music, sex. All day long, every minute that she wasn't with him, he missed her. But when she fell asleep at night, before him, always, his thoughts wandered to Rosalind, which made him think about San Francisco and his old life, and the anger would rise through him again, shapeless and aimless, but white hot. This went on for months. It might have gone on much longer if Rosalind hadn't sent him word that his mother had died. He knew as soon as he read the telegram that that was the end of it. He'd never go back to San Francisco. Again, his anger rose, but this time there was nowhere to run. So he threw himself back into work. The First World War was 2 years over by then, and there was talent to be found, money to be made. He needed more than to be drunk and in love. He needed to be busy, worn out. He bought a burgeoning film studio, Royal Pictures, and put Nina under contract. When her first film came out, a comedy, he filled his newspapers with rapturous reviews of her performance, but it took two more for her star to truly rise. As the money came back to him, it always did, he began to do something new and novel for Gerald, for any Ives. He spent it. Not invested, not gambled, spent. Vengefully. He couldn't have the White House? Fine. He built himself a fortress on the California coast and filled it with beautiful, pleasurable things. He covered the grounds with gardens and citrus trees, threw lavish parties most Saturday nights. On Nina's birthday, he brought in elephants and tigers. He invited her Hollywood friends to stay for weeks on end, and they swam drunk and naked in the indoor pool together beneath a ceiling draped in gauzy fabric. And they fought. Oh, God, did they fight. Rosalind had never so much as raised her voice to him. Nina did. Every time she learned of one of his infidelities, of which there were many, she screamed at him, and whenever he suspected one of hers, likely there were none, he screamed back. They'd fight in front of their friends, throw things at walls, storm onto the grounds, and spit at each other. But it never made it to the gossip rags, because by then he owned them all. So long as his family didn't have to read about him, about his boundless rage, then it would be as if he no longer existed. All his fury would burn itself out without ever touching them. But of course, that wasn't what happened. Because Nina fell sick. 12. The mystery illness, I say. I remember reading about that. 2 years where Nina Gill couldn't work, right as talkies started coming out.
And she was in the news more than ever, Margaret agrees. I can guess what your Dove Franklin had to say about all of that in his so-called book.
Since when am I responsible for him? I tease. I'm not even the one who bought that book. Blame my parents. But yes, he had his theories about her time away. She flashes me a smile over the ceaseless movement of her hands among the glass shards.
Let me guess. She couldn't hack it in the changing landscape of Hollywood. No one wanted her in the talkies, and her star began to fall even faster than it had risen, leading to a 2-year mental breakdown, the likes of which she never fully recovered from.
I nod. An actress at the height of her fame taking a 2-year hiatus and then spending the majority of that in and out of hospitals around the world. A mental breakdown seemed less far-fetched to me than some of his other theories. Her hand still on her tools, and something passes across her face.
There are all kinds of reasons for a woman to want to disappear. Always have been.
Such as? I say gently. Margaret peels her gloves off her small but calloused hands.
Let's walk back to the house. Jody will certainly bring lunch here, but she won't be happy about it. She doesn't like waiting on me.
Is she paid to? I ask, since still no information about their relationship has been provided to me. Margaret's head cocks prettily to one side.
No, I wouldn't say that,
she settles on, as enigmatic of an answer as I would have expected from her. I pack up my things, and we leave the workshop, the doors still ajar and unlocked, the ceiling fan still twirling. We start down the path, in the opposite direction from which Jody and I arrived, curving around the other side of the garden beds back toward the house. When I point this out, Margaret nods.
It's all the same path. You just stay on it, and you'll get where you're going eventually.
Like the labyrinth, I say, clutching my recorder, still running, in one hand and my phone in the other.
More or less, she says. I've thought about turning the whole thing into a mosaic, connecting it to the labyrinth. Probably don't have that many years left of my life, though. That's a lot of work.
So it was on purpose, I say, the unicursal path.
I like taking away that element of decision whenever I can.
Why's that? I ask.
Because it gives me peace, she says. Remembering my decisions don't make much of a difference in the end.
I balk, even miss a step. You really think that? Another sly, nearly coquettish smile, and at 87 years old, she's still pulling it off.
Think. Hope. Somewhere in between the two.
The path curls down to walk along the marsh, and I see a fanboat docked among the reeds. You use that much? I ask.
Not much, she says. But more often than I use the car.
That hardly tells me anything, I point out.
Now you're catching on, she teases.
But honestly, I'm not. When I let her talk, she'll talk, But when I want a straight answer, she's more evasive, which once again begs the question, what am I doing here? I'm curious about something, I say.
I'd describe you as curious about everything,
Margaret parries. Hazard of the trade, I say, then admit. Or more realistically, I was just born this way.
Sounds like you're on a unicursal path of your own, she reasons.
She doesn't invite me to ask my question, but I do anyway. Why now?
What do you mean?
She says innocently. I give her a look, and she laughs.
Every once in a while, you've got some bite, Alice Scott. I like that.
Thank you. And I like when you answer the questions I ask. Another laugh.
I know I look great, but I'm old. If not now, when?
Right, I agree. But never was an option. Something had to have convinced you to talk to me. And as great as I am, I don't buy that it was my rambling voicemail. We pause at the back doors to Margaret's house.
I made a promise to someone, she says. And then they died before I could tell them I took it back.
You're not going to tell me who, are you? I ask. She smiles and opens the door.
Not today.
As we step inside, from somewhere deeper in the house, Jody grunts,
You're back. Nothing gets past you, does it?
Margaret leads me through a door into a bright, powder-blue kitchen where Jody's slicing sandwiches into tiny triangles.
Tuna salad?
Margaret asks, leaning over Jody's shoulder to look at the cutting board.
Cucumber,
Jody says.
And now that you're back, you can take over.
Margaret gives a belabored sigh, but still steps up to the task when Jody retreats to wash her hands over the deep double sink, its overhead window looking out on the backyard. How long does it usually take a person to get used to this house? I ask. I don't understand how anything is connected. I would have thought we were at the front of the house here.
There's no usually,
Margaret says. I frown, which makes her laugh.
Not a facial expression I've seen you do much of, she says.
On her way out of the room, Jody says,
No one has to get used to the house because no one except us is ever in it.
Ever? I ask. Margaret gives an unbothered shrug.
More or less.
How do you sell your work? To the shops and galleries? I ask. She waves a hand.
Oh, Jody handles all that. Not that there's much to handle. Like I said, most tourists are looking for a different sort of thing than what I do.
That certainly explains the reaction from the shopkeeper who'd finally passed along Margaret's contact information. He'd said something along the lines of, You're welcome to it, but if Irene Mayberry is actually Margaret Ives, then I'm Elvis. What about groceries? I ask.
Jody, she says. Jody handles it all.
And what, you just stay in this house all day?
I stay in the yard, mostly, Margaret says. Or out on the boat, or in my home.
That's gotta be lonely, I say.
Less so than you'd think, she retorts. You get used to it, isolation. Funny thing is, I was already used to it by the time I disappeared.
Meaning? I ask.
No more chit-chat right now, she says. It's nearly dinner time, and no one needs to see the inside of my mouth while I'm eating.
On Friday, the morning after my best session with Margaret yet, I'm picking through my notes and typing up an extremely uninspiring, though blessedly short, article on new skincare trends for the scratch when Theo texts me.
I'm shooting in Atlanta right now, he says.
Oh, nice, I write back. Who/what?
That new fashion designer, Mogi, he replies. Should be a good time.
He's not giving me a ton of conversational ammo here, but I'd rather be doing anything than working right now while sitting out on Little Croissant's patio, sweating through my sundress, so I write back anyway. Yeah, Atlanta's super cool. Let me know if you want any recs.
How far is it from where you are? He says.
I do a quick search to double check.
Not that close, like 3.5 hours by car.
Shit,
he says. A second later,
a new message buzzes in. What are you up to this weekend?
Oh, nothing. Just more meandering interviews that manage to avoid almost anything juicy from a story I'm sure is 90% juice.
Nothing today. Working tomorrow during the day, then nothing Sunday and Monday.
Nice, he says, adding, I prob will be done by Saturday night too.
The text just hangs there, and understanding clicks into place.
He's doing what he always does.
Not quite asking me to ask him to hang out. It's annoying how indirect he always is, but at least there's some comfort in knowing him well enough to read between the lines, unlike the horror that unfolded between me and Hayden the other night. I take a screenshot of the exchange and text it to my friends. Priya is the first to reply.
A girl's gotta eat, Alice.
Bianca is right behind her. Turn in your skincare piece. Also, barf. Killian slides in next.
My enemy.
I thumb up Bianca's text first, then write out my reply. I'm going to invite him to come down, but that's where I draw the line. I will not be asking him whether I can fly to him.
Tell him he can meet you there, then send him this address,
Killian says. I follow the link he sent. It takes me to a map of Antarctica, a little pin over something called the Pole of Inaccessibility Research Station.
Will do, I say, then text Theo. You're welcome to come down if you want. There's not a ton to do, but there's at least one cute bar, restaurant, and a good coffee shop, and it's beautiful.
Really?
Theo says.
Yes.
Sure, why not? I could drive down when I finish up tomorrow afternoon. Meet around 7?
Sounds good,
I tell him, then turn my phone over and click back to yesterday's notes. We covered a decent amount of ground. Nina Gill's mystery illness, the fluctuating weight, the hair loss, the months she'd spent in the Swiss Alps while she recovered. During their time apart, Nina had fallen in love with her doctor, and in the aftermath of her and Gerald's breakup, he finally reconnected with his sister, Gigi, whose English husband had died not long after she discovered she was pregnant. Gerald insisted on moving Gigi and her new baby, Ruth, onto his estate, now that Nina had moved out and on with the doctor. Out of the blue, I'd asked Margaret, and she'd given one of those dry, secretive smiles.
Nothing is out of the blue when it comes to my family, she said. Not ever.
I could feel the hidden meaning beneath the words, but when I pressed her on it, she evaded me, just kept going with her story. For a time, Gerald had continued his management of Nina's career, even after her marriage. But the truth was, even with his media pull, the time away had changed the landscape too much for her. The reviews of her newer films were mostly concerned with the physical toll her illness had taken on her. She'd visibly aged and gained a fair bit of weight, and an outlet beyond Gerald's control had nicknamed her the not-so-ingenue, with the emphasis on new. The audiences had tired of her, too. As far as they were concerned, she belonged to the silent film era, and every time she spoke, her surprising voice convinced them she'd overstayed her welcome. She left the business entirely in 1931, and that same year, Gerald moved his wife, Rosalind, and his now grown children down to the House of Ives, as if the last 12 years apart had never happened. Freddie and Francine were 27 and 26, respectively, by then, both unmarried and neither excited about relocating their entire lives. But Gerald controlled all the money, and so when he said jump, they jumped. Thus, he, his wife, his grown children, his sister Gigi, and her daughter Ruth all wound up living in the same house. If you could call the Ives estate a house, and honestly, I don't think you can, but still.
Gerald and Rosalind never shared a room again, of course, Margaret told me. They were cold, but cordial, and it was much too late for him to fix his relationship with his own children, but his niece was just a baby. So essentially, all that opulence Gerald had lavished on his mistress was turned toward baby Ruth at that point. She was the light of his life. The world had probably never seen such a spoiled child, until Laura and I came along anyway. But she was good-natured to her core. When she was small, her nickname was Little Princess, And even when Laura and I were little girls and Ruth was a young woman, we all mostly called her LP. It wasn't a bad interview. It was arguably good, but I could feel that there was more lurking just underneath what she was saying, and she still didn't trust me enough to share it. I'd offered multiple times to stop recording, but she'd waved off the offer. "You can trust me," I promised her. She parried with, "You can trust me, too." It effectively ended the discussion. If I wanted her to open up to me, I had to respect that she had her own reasons for what she chose to share and when. Margaret refused to be rushed, and I knew that pushing would only slow us down in the long run. If I got the job, there'd be plenty of time to dig into these stories. My only real goal these next 3.5 weeks was to earn her trust. I just had to hope Hayden wasn't having better luck than I was. On Saturday morning, I'm driving through the fog to Margaret's house when she calls to cancel on me. "Something came up," she says through my rental car's speakers when I take her call. I put on my blinker and pull off into the little croissant, gift shop, enclave parking lot. "No problem at all," I assure her. "If you just need a few hours, we could meet later." "Not today," she says stiffly. "Then tomorrow?" I suggest. "Not tomorrow either," she says. And Monday she'll be meeting with Hayden. I ignore the sinking sensation in my chest, grapple for a grip on the hope that this doesn't mean she's close to firing me before I've even been hired. I clear my throat. "Should we just pick things back up during our Tuesday session?" I ask, crossing all of my fingers against the steering wheel as I pull into a shady parking spot. "If I can, yes," she says, but offers nothing else. "Okay, well, if things change on your end, or even if you just need something, don't be afraid to reach out." "You're a sweet girl," she says, and I swear there's a hint of regret in her voice. She's about to fire me, isn't she? I swallow a lump of emotion and let my hand hover over the button to end the call. "Okay, well, take care, Margaret." "You too, Alice," she says, and we hang up. I sit, staring at the wheel, trying all my best pep talks on myself and, for once, getting nowhere. With a groan, I slump forward. Something thunks next to my left ear, and I sit up with a yelp spinning toward the window. A gap-toothed man in a bucket hat grins at me from the other side of the glass. Captain Cecil gives a hearty wave, then steps back to make room for the door as I swing it open and step out into the heat. "There she is," he says, like I'm just the person he wanted to see. Me, a perfect stranger he's bumped into twice. Instantly, my mood lifts. My heart very nearly soars. I've found a kindred spirit in Cecil, and it makes me realize how lonely I've been since the awkwardness with Hayden last week. I should be used to the isolation of this job, but I'm not sure I ever will be. "I was wondering when I'd run into you again," I tell him.
"And I you," he says. "I have an invitation for you."
"Oh," I say, intrigued.
"Fishbowl's having a little soiree tonight," he says.
"I do love a soiree," I say. "Celebrating anything in particular?"
"As a matter of fact, yes," he says. "It's an annual fete in honor of my birthday."
"Oh, wow, happy birthday," I say. He chortles.
"Thank you, dear, but my birthday isn't until December. This is just in honor of my birthday, which happens to be Christmas. I always thought that was a raw deal, so I started throwing myself a summer bash about 10 years ago and never looked back."
"Genius," I say, and his grin widens again.
"I think so," he agrees. "Anyway, small bites provided, no gifts required, and drinks at happy hour prices. Stop by if you feel so inclined."
"I will," I promise him. "Would it be all right if I brought a friend?"
"Already made a friend," he cries. "Other than me, of course."
I laugh. "Well, no, someone from back home. He's driving up from Atlanta later today."
"Sure, bring him along," he says. "It's a more the merrier situation."
"My favorite kind," I say.
"Then I'll see you sometime between 7 and midnight, Miss Scott."
He tips his bucket hat at me and saunters off.
The smell of ground coffee beans beckons me, a siren call coming from Little Croissant. I grab my laptop from my back seat and head toward the Robin's Egg Blue Coffee Shop's elevated platform. I'm out, so I might as well enjoy it. But if I can't interview Margaret, I'm at least going to do some independent research. I order an iced brown sugar latte at the window, then take it down to the flagstone patio. Some deep part of my subconscious feels his presence and sends an uncanny prickle to the back of my neck in the second before my gaze sweeps over the hunched, hulking shape of Hayden Anderson. His computer sits on the little mosaic table in front of him, but his eyes are right on me. There's no pretending we didn't see each other. For once, I wish I was a little less chronically polite, that I was as comfortable with a good scowl or blank stare as the man 4 feet in front of me. "Hello," I say coolly.
"Hi."
His reply is terse, uncomfortable. Everything about him is terse and uncomfortable, which makes me feel a little better about our last humiliating encounter. Another beat. "Anyway," I turn toward the table farthest from him. It's probably only 15 feet away, but I think I can manage to pass 5 minutes there before finding an excuse to leave.
"Shouldn't you be with Margaret today?"
he asks. My shoulders rise protectively. I should brush him off, make an excuse, or flat out not answer. That's what he would do. Unfortunately, I'm still, at my core, me. I'm already marching back to his table, the truth pouring out of me. "She canceled." His face betrays nothing. It so fully betrays nothing that I'm positive he knows something, which I say as I plop down in the iron chair opposite him.
"I don't,"
he says. Somehow, I can hear the technicality in his voice. He's telling the truth, but only just. "So you don't know why she canceled," I say. "But you have a guess." He lets out a sigh.
"I'm not going to speculate, Alice."
"No, I know," I say. "You wouldn't possibly share any helpful information with me, even though I am the smallest and least significant threat to this job that you can possibly imagine." His jaw clenches.
"You're putting words in my mouth."
I'm reading between the lines. I counter. He leans forward over the table, our knees clashing under it.
"Just because you've made a decision about how I feel," he growls, "doesn't make it true."
"So what, you're not positive Margaret's going to hire you over me?" I ask.
"I'm reasonably certain," he replies cautiously. "Would you rather I kept that from you?"
"You're pretty keen to keep everything else from me," I say. His frown deepens. His lips part as if he's debating saying something. A sigh escapes him right before he caves.
"I can't give this up."
I shift in my seat, my anger abating and leaving me unpleasantly vulnerable. That much I understand. That much I don't blame him for. I expected him to fight for this opportunity, just like I am. "I know," I admit. "Neither can I." He holds my gaze for one long moment.
"I would like to be friends."
At my surprised laugh, his inky brows draw together.
"What's funny about that?"
he wants to know. "Don't take this the wrong way," I warn. "But you sound like a robot learning to love." His face screws up in bafflement.
"I don't know any way to take that."
"I just mean you've pushed me away, kissed me, and insulted me," I say. "And now you're formally proposing friendship."
"I wouldn't describe our relationship until now like that, exactly,"
he says, visibly and audibly dismayed. My head cocks to one side. "How would you describe it?" His eyes train on his green tea. He pushes it farther from the ledge.
"So you don't want to be friends?"
"You're putting words in my mouth," I retort. He barely smiles.
"What are you doing tonight?"
"Tonight?" I ask. "Hot date. At Fishbowl."
"Ah, too bad," he says.
"Were you going to ask me to hang out?" I ask.
"If you thought you could go one night without talking about Margaret Ives,"
he says.
Then yes.
Ah, I say. Too bad.
Maybe next month,
he says. Maybe, I agree, standing. If you can forgive me for taking your job. 13. My last text from Theo came in at 3 p.m.
Finishing up here soon.
One good thing about Theo, Boris, is that he is, like me, a social creature by nature. Not only was he delighted at the thought of going to Cecil's not birthday party, but he'd offered to meet me there, so I didn't have to wait on him. I work until 6, then take a quick shower, swipe on some mascara, and head out for the night. Downtown is packed, and I have to park 4 blocks away. As I'm doing so, my phone buzzes with a message from my mom. I say message, but really it's just a link to an article about how California is going to eventually go up in flames, then break off from the rest of the country and sink to the floor of the ocean. Ever since I first moved to LA, I've gotten a text like this a few times a year, with such regularity that at times I've wondered whether she has a calendar alert set to nudge me about my new home's impending doom. I tried to accept it as a form of love, even if the greater implication was also that all my decisions were wrong. Wow, that's terrible, I write back, and before I hit send, I stop short just outside a fishbowl, guilt creeping in. I should be checking in with her more often, making sure she's okay. Dad would be so disappointed if he knew how little we've seen each other since he died. I'm in Georgia for a story, I add, and I was wondering if I could drive down to see you next weekend. Sure, she says. Not the most emphatic of responses, but still, a weight eases off my chest. I tuck my phone into my bag and step inside. If fishbowl verged on overstimulating during my last visit, this time it can only be described as visually cacophonous. From the fishnet-covered ceiling, dozens, if not hundreds, of colored paper lanterns hang. Massive bouquets of tropical flowers sit atop every table, and most of the guests are dressed in bold florals to match. The theme, if there is one, appears to be bright. The place is packed, but hardly any tables are taken, everyone standing and milling instead. I pick my way over to the bartender and ask for something tropical and non-alcoholic. He comes back with a tangerine-colored concoction in a goblet, an orchid spilling out over the top of it. Open or closed? He asks about my tab when I hand over my credit card. Open's fine. He cups a hand around his ear and leans in to hear me over the roar of both the crowd and the music. Opens? Fine! He goes to run the card, then slides it back over the counter as I scan for anyone I might recognize. Cecil's nowhere in sight, and the only other person I've met before, in any capacity, is Sherry, the waitress, carrying a tray of some kind of cheese puff treat around. I retreat to the booth in the corner to wait for Theo. When I sent the address to him, he'd sent a thumbs up back, but no other acknowledgement. I do the math in my head, trying to guess how much longer it might take him to get here. I send him one more text. ETA? Rather than pretending to be engrossed by my phone, I opt to set it aside and try to look approachable. This mainly consists of gazing hopefully around the room for anyone not already engaged in conversation whom I could make small talk with. I would have been more careful what I wished for if I'd thought for even one second that there was a chance Hayden might be here. Again. He's the stillest thing in the room, which makes him stand out. His height, even sitting, and his stark black and white wardrobe don't help either. He's at a table on the far side of the restaurant, and I become acutely aware that I've taken his go-to spot in the corner near the bathrooms. He lifts his water glass in greeting. I lift my ridiculous mocktail back. Then he unfurls from his seat and stalks toward me. Twice in one day, I say.
It's a small island, he says.
Still, I say, an incredible coincidence.
Can I sit?
He asks. I glance toward the door.
Your hot date,
he says.
Right.
He's running late, I say, just a hair defensive.
I can keep you company, he offers. If you'd like.
His voice is low,
even, warm, a surprisingly inviting combination. I glance at the time on my phone again, finishing off the calculation that spotting Hayden had interrupted. "For a minute," I say. "He won't be much longer." His chin dips once, and he slides into the booth across from me.
"So, are you here tonight by coincidence, or have you also met Cecil?"
I crack a smile. "Cecil invited me, and I was feeling pretty special for that until 10 seconds ago."
"Oh, you should still feel special,"
Hayden assures me.
"He only invited me because he decided, based on nothing, I should add, that I'm doing a write-up on this place."
I laugh. "No, that's pretty much why I'm here too."
"Maybe,"
he allows.
"But was he smiling when he invited you?"
"I have yet to see that man not smiling," I say.
"And that, Scott, is where our experiences with Cecil diverge."
I shift in my seat, suppressing a laugh. Even when I want to be cold with him, I can't. Maybe I should just give it up. Except that, as is typical for me, I like and even respect someone regardless of whether they like or respect me. "Then why'd you come?" I ask him. He stares at me for a beat.
"I felt bad."
"Honestly, I doubt Cecil would have noticed if either of us didn't show up," I say, "especially since he doesn't even seem to be here." He gives one firm shake of his head.
"Not about that. About the other night."
Oh, God. A burn begins at the tips of my ears, spreading toward my face. At the top of the list of things I want in this moment, to pretend the kiss never happened. My phone starts ringing on the table between us, Theo's name flashing on screen. Once again, the universe is coming through for me. I flash Hayden my sunniest smile. "My date." I tip my head toward my phone and answer the call, turning sideways on the bench. "Theo?"
"Alice, hi."
Whatever he says next gets lost in the noise. "Oh, hold on a second," I tell him. "I have to go outside. I can't hear you." I excuse myself from Hayden with a one-minute gesture and head out to the street. "You still there?"
"I'm sorry, Alice,"
he says.
"Sorry?"
As I say it, something sinks in my chest.
"The photo shoot ran long,"
he says. "Well, that's fine," I promise him. "How far away are you?" He sighs.
"I haven't left yet."
"Oh." I turn back to the window, inadvertently meeting Hayden's eyes. The embarrassment and disappointment bubble over then in the form of stinging tears. I face the street again, urging my voice into steadiness.
"So what are you thinking?"
"I just bit off more than I can chew," he says. "It would have been fun to meet up, but my flight's tomorrow night, so at this point, I feel like I should probably just chill here. The drive wouldn't be worth it, I don't think."
I stop myself, right in the nick of time, from suggesting he change his flight to leave from here. Surely this has already occurred to him. He travels as much as I do. He knows how all of this works. It's not worth it to him. That's the end of the conversation. And it's not a surprise, but after the last few days of emotional highs and lows, it hits me harder than it should. "I understand," I tell him. "We'll just catch up later."
"I knew you'd get it," he says. "You're the best, Alice."
I smile, but can't quite will myself to thank him for the compliment. I clear my throat.
"Get home safe."
"Enjoy the rest of your stay," he tells me. "See you back in LA.
"Yep,"
I cheep. He says bye and clicks off. For a second, I just stand there, phone still pressed to my ear, debating what to do. I can't face Hayden right now. It was bad enough being rejected by him mid-makeout. Now I've bragged about a date that isn't happening. But my purse is still inside, sitting at the table with him. "Get your bag, go home, and get back to work," I tell myself. "It will be fine. A nice night in might be exactly what I need. I can text my friends and do some more research, or else settle in with some key lime pie and reality TV. All that stands in my way is walking through that door and snatching my purse. I can do it." I steel myself, drop my phone to my side, and march back in. Hayden's brow shoots upward at something in my expression as I approach.
"Everything okay?"
he asks. Fine, I say, grabbing the strap of my bag. Something just came up, so I've got to head out.
Like an emergency?
Sort of. I avoid eye contact while I stuff my phone into my bag. Enjoy your night. I hear him call my name at my back, but with the party in full swing, I figure I have plausible deniability there. I don't turn around. I just flee down the dark street. I've made it two blocks toward my car when I hear him shout my name again. Shit.
I have to go,
I call back, not slowing my pace. It doesn't matter. He's too tall. He's got the advantage. He catches up to me right as I'm turning down.